series in 1993, talks, reflections, dialogues, discussions. Somebody was saying the other day that the dialogue is the appropriate term, because that's the kind of, when you, each person is able to, you kind of listen to each other and talk to each other with a mutual interest of listening, understanding, and then discussions, that is from the Greek word discus, which means to throw things at somebody. And there's different ways of, you see people talking, having discussions, and it does like that sometimes, people just kind of throwing their words at somebody else. Sometimes you feel that people don't listen to each other, they just talk at each other. And living in a community, of course, this is even more apparent, where you're very much aware of, we have to live closely with people, and where we all kind of are to blame. We all have our days of talking at each other and throwing discs at each other. Or then what really works is a dialogue, or to have way of listening, and inevitably one has to use the word discuss, but listening and trying to understand, and listen beyond just the kind of meaning or the superficial impression one gets. I've made many mistakes by just taking things too superficially, by just listening to the surface, or what somebody might be just saying on a verbal level, and oftentimes miss the point of what they're actually saying, because you're taking it too literally, or you're not really listening. You find yourself reacting to what people say, and then kind of saying something back out of a reaction. And then the Buddha's emphasis on reflection. And this, the reflexive mind, this is the Buddha emphasized the using of this ability to reflect and contemplate on the feeling, on the meaning, on the movement of life. They used words like sati and sampajanya, these Pali words, convey that ability of reflexive thinking and contemplation. Like sati is the ability to bring into your mind the conditions affecting you, the time, the place, the mood, the people, the situation you're in. And sampajanya is being able to keep aware, kind of self-observation, ability to sustain an awareness around what you're actually feeling or what's actually happening inside you. So that this ability to reflect, reflection, contemplation, brings us to that point where we begin to have insight. We begin to understand things in a deeper way, not just be caught up in maybe just a definitions or intellectual definitions of terms, or it's so easy to take everything for granted that because say for most of us English is our native tongue, we're kind of conditioned to think in English, and therefore we think we really understand it. Where a lot of times your native tongue is merely just a mental habit you've developed. Till you start contemplating it more, trying to use, say, the language as a means of communication, to try to use it in a skillful way, so that what you're feeling or what's happening to you, what you're thinking, is you're being able to maybe convey that to somebody else, to communicate with somebody else. We can see that some the problems of the world that we face are just the the prejudiced assumptions we make and the biases and the way that we can come from very fixed prejudgments or viewpoints, have a prejudice against something that influences us, and so that we don't even hear what somebody is saying. We're merely hearing what we think they're saying because we've already decided that they're this way or that way. So you can see, like, with problems in developing relations between the Israelis and the Palestinians, or the Serbs and the Croats, and the Bosnian Muslims, and on and on, the endless, the old Cold War of the Soviet Union and the West, just the way we already had our views, our opinions about them, and tended to interpret everything they did in from that bias, always seeing it from that distortion of bias and assumption, rather than being aware of that. Like with this Sati and Sampachanya, you can actually be aware if you do have a bias. Suddenly you realize, yeah, I'm projecting onto this person. I already have an opinion about this person, and you begin to feel it. You begin to be aware of your own tendency to speak from a position, or to have a particular hidden agenda, as they say now. Particular message that you want to throw at somebody. So these talks in the afternoon here at Amaravati are for contemplation, you know, opening on the mind to listen and to watch your own reaction, not to just think in terms of going along with what I say or objecting to it, but just seeing how it, what it does to your mind, how you respond to it, or how you emotionally react to it. Meditation in daily life. I thought this would be a good title for the last talk, because meditation is a subject that has now become quite respectable in Britain. When I came to Britain 17 years ago, didn't have the same respectability as it does now. It was people thought it was a very odd thing to be doing, meditating. But it shows that over, just in a short period of time, really, something has changed in this country, an attitude. And meditation is now something that you hear many people talking about and interested in, or many people go on meditation retreats. There's an interest in the mind itself, in trying to understand and trying to learn how to live with it, with oneself. Remember, with somebody else, we only have to live with them sometimes, but we have to be with ourselves all the time. And so even though somebody else might be difficult, usually it's our minds that give us the most amount of suffering and problems. At least as far as I'm concerned, I've given myself more problems and created more misery in my mind than anyone else I can ever think of. Nobody I know of has been as relentlessly critical to me as I have been to myself. So learning how to live with myself, and learning how to meditation implies some kind of mental activity. And it can be, we think of it in various terms of meditating on a subject, like in Christian meditation, oftentimes it's on the sorrows and joys of the Christ, or certain subjects, religious subjects one can meditate upon. And in Buddhism, it's a way of realizing the Dhamma, or the aim of Buddhist meditation is towards a profound realization of the truth. And the truth then is something that only you can realize for yourself. It's not truth that other people tell you are truth. It's not given to you by somebody else. It's a realization. And so to realize something means that you need to become fully aware, fully familiar with the way you are. Not as a person, not analyzing yourself as a personality, because then we get back into all kinds of problems about ourselves as personalities. But the way it actually is as a human being, being born in this form, living within a human body the way it is, with its senses, its sensitivity, its intelligence, its emotions, its instincts, and so forth, how to get to understand and know this very being that we live with all the time, but sometimes we understand ourselves the least. Sometimes it's easier to understand the dog or the cat better than it is ourselves. Because to get to know oneself truly, we have to get beyond just what we think about ourselves or we assume about ourselves. The assumptions you have about what you are, what you should be, or what you shouldn't be. And get to the very ground of being, of this conscious experience and the feeling of it, the sensitivity of it, so that you're looking at it, reflecting upon it, contemplating it as it is, with no standard of how it should be, you know, that it should be some fit to some level of ideal or of perfection, that you might think should be. But with reflective meditation, we're contemplating the way it actually is. Even if it isn't very nice, we're still contemplating it for what it is, not saying it should be otherwise, but recognizing that sensitivity itself is the experience of this range of pleasure and pain, of happiness and suffering, that human life is this way. It always has been and always will be for all of us, from the most privileged human beings to the most unfortunate ones. We still have this range of experience from very high kind of refined pleasurable states to its total opposite, total misery. Meditation and daily life. Now, it's interesting to see what meditation has become in the West. I remember when I went, before I came to Britain, I'd been living in Asia for about 13 years and had never returned to the States to see my parents. So then in 1976, my mother was very ill, so I went back to the States. And with the idea that possibly of, in the future, if there was enough interest, maybe trying to establish something in the United States, a Buddhist monastery. And while I was there, since I hadn't been in the States for about 13 years, I would be invited to various Buddhist groups, meditation groups that had formed. And one thing that did, and at that time I noticed that not many Americans were really meditating at that time. That was 1976, and so I went to lectures. I went to a lecture in Massachusetts, near Boston, and the American people that were listening to it was a Japanese Roshi who was giving a talk, and the people that were listening were just all over the place, most restless kind of people, you know, squirming and moving around and very undignified behavior. I mean, they're listening to this this Japanese Roshi, who is the most impeccable kind of solid-looking figure, sitting in a chair, sitting erect and completely composed, and he was very impressive. But all the rest of the people looked like, like a can of worms or something, just everything squirming and writhing. And so I thought, Americans, hopeless. Then going back a few years later to various meditation groups or giving teachings or giving courses in the States, and I began to see these American meditators as very still, incredibly kind of poised and still bodies in a meditation hall. And I realized that over the years that the effect of meditation had brought this kind of level of impressive composure to many of my fellow countrymen, which I was quite pleased to see that just that alone was that Americans, instead of this endless restlessness that's so common to American society, there was a measure of calm and composure and collection taking place. And that I could see was very much needed in that society, and people were longing for it, but the society itself before that had never offered any kind of possibilities for one to ever develop in that way. And now, of course, there's meditation centers all over the United States, and people love to sit still. In fact, when you go to some of these meditation centers, they talk about sitting all the time. They don't talk about meditation anymore. They say, well, let's go and sit. And how many hours have you sat? And I went to Sri Lanka to sit. So I spent 6 months sitting in Sri Lanka. If you didn't know what they meant, you think this is a strange thing to be doing, going all the way to Sri Lanka just to sit for 6 months. But then I knew what they were talking about, that sitting had become meditation for people, that this, because of the stillness that the mind can, that you can have in the sitting posture. You can sit still, and then after a while, as you practice some meditation technique, the thinking process tends to calm down, the emotions are tranquilized, and you can oftentimes have quite a pleasurable or pleasant, tranquilizing experience of sitting. And then when you get up, but as soon as you start walking, it all goes away. In fact, some of these places, they tell me after that they'll have maybe these long meditation retreats where they sit most of the time, and after a few months, some of these people don't want to go back to New York or Philadelphia. They have to push them onto the coaches to get them out of the place. Because the thing is that the mind itself, once you begin to get in touch with the beyond just the conditioning of the mind, to the purity of the mind, the stillness of the mind, that is probably the most pleasant human experience that you can have. It's much better than having a good time. Having an exciting time, and it does take a different attitude. I mean, like going out and having a good time, getting high, having an exciting, absolutely absorbing, scintillating time means you have to go out and seek something and do something, and try to sustain a level of happiness and hilarity in order to feel that. And then it takes a lot of effort, and it's very exhausting to do it. But then to get in touch with the stillness of the mind means that you don't go out, you go inward. Instead of going out on the town, instead of painting the town red, going out and seeking excitement, you go find some really quiet place where there's absolutely nothing exciting going on, and sit down, close your eyes. And then you become a different kind of being. Oftentimes you don't, anything that exciting comes along, you feel very upset when anything exciting happens. And once you if you sustain that through, say, sensory deprivation, like controlling a situation where you don't allow any raucous noises or any disruptive activity to take place, in a quiet, still hall where it is completely silent. No one is allowed to talk, and everything is under control, and there's nothing to look at, nothing to listen to. So you can kind of, after a while, as you get used to that, you experience a blissful state that comes through depriving the senses of stimulating impingement. And that, of course, is a kind of happiness that we can also become addicted to. We want to live on a permanent meditation retreat. We'd like to find a way of life in which we can just sit in this stillness and abide there, and not have all these worldly problems, responsibilities, disruptions, aggravations, all these worldly problems coming at us. And so it's and it makes us sometimes very selfish, very averse to doing anything other than just finding out when the next meditation retreat is taking place. But that's not what the Buddha meant either. He wasn't teaching a kind of quietism of avoiding life and finding a place where you just cut yourself off from everything that is distracting, disruptive, or unpleasant. Because when we look at his own example, as recorded in the Pali Canon, we realize he, after his own enlightenment, he lived a very active life, really. Spent the rest of his life, going around teaching, establishing order of monks and nuns, and having to deal with endless problems and disruptions and worldly situations that could be quite horrible in themselves. And yet, the Buddha's meditation was something that was inside him. It wasn't dependent. His calm wasn't dependent on depriving the senses of stimulation, but being able to understand things as they are. So this is the aim of the Buddhist practice. It's not a hermetic or eremetic quietism of throwing the world out and living in a place with no responsibility and no distraction, but in being able to understand this form, this body that we have, our own body, our own sensitivity, to be able to learn how to deal with emotional reactions, instinctual energies, through understanding them, not through control, not through trying to suppress or trying to get anything that you don't have, trying to get something and hold on to it, but through this ability to understand, to reflect upon, to contemplate the way it is. So then, with this kind of knowledge, then this environment, the situation we're in, isn't the important issue. Our happiness, our peace of mind, isn't dependent upon a quiet place anymore, or things being harmonious, or everything going in a nice and an easy way. In fact, we find that it's interesting in the establishing the Sangha here in Britain. There was, of course, longing. I think all of us who've become monks or nuns are the kind of people that long for this harmonious lifestyle, and a meditative lifestyle where the ideal of it is everybody is kind of working together, practicing together, supporting each other's spiritual aspirations. And it sounds very idealistic and very wonderful in itself as a theory, on the level of how it should be. But as an actual experience, in monasteries, you have to deal with your own karma, which is that even though you're living with some of the nicest people in the world, you still manage to hate them a lot of the time. No matter how good and moral and sincere they might be, they can still irritate you and exasperate you. And one can feel, completely murderous impulses sometimes towards some of the nicest people. Why is that? We shouldn't be like that. We should all be these kind of saints that are always, our thoughts and our emotions are always of the most pure and lovely qualities. But yet this is life, isn't it? In learning to understand these things, we actually resolve these problems. And so that in meditation and daily life is where the meditation really needs to be focused. How to maintain a level of mindfulness and awareness and reflection in the experiences that we have, in just the ordinary things we do in daily life. Now, in a monastic situation, that the whole monastic lifestyle is built around that alone. It's really the Buddha established the discipline itself in a way that monks and nuns are encouraged to reflect and contemplate themselves in a continuous way. Like the advice is, when you're putting on the robes, be fully with the action of putting on the robe. Mindful while putting on the robe. Mindful while taking off the robe. Mindful while eating your food and washing your alms bowl. And all these, the most ordinary things that we do are pointed to in our discipline of how to be aware and completely with what you are doing. Just the simple action of putting on your robe or taking it off or eating your food or washing your alms bowl. Now these are just the part of a daily life. Here in Amravati, I've been trying to encourage mindfulness around opening and closing doors, without great success. There's so many doors in this place. And this isn't in the Vinaya. I think they take it seriously because it's not written down. I managed to make a few kind of horrendous growls about it now and then. But this is how we can bring attention to daily life, just through going through a door, through acknowledging or bringing into your consciousness what is actually taking place, using a door as a something to give special emphasis to. Because in a country like this, where we say, and especially as it's getting cold, getting on to winter, doors become more meaningful to us, especially closed doors. Washing the dishes. There's another good way of meditating in daily life, because people think, well, I have to wash the dishes, but I'd really rather meditate. I didn't come here to wash the dishes. I came here to learn meditation. So you hear that? Washing the dishes keeps me from doing my practice, my meditation. And so we, instead of looking at washing the dishes as some chore that has to be done or that's kind of forced on you, you transform washing the dishes into a meditation. And so this is like taking some kind of very ordinary activity. And oftentimes activities that we tend to dismiss as just tedious chores, or I remember, you know, like washing the dishes to me was because my mother used to force me to do it. I always had this aversion to it. You know, like, because my memories of it was that my mother would say, you have to wash the dishes, and you'd always feel this resistance, I don't want to. And sometimes one never grows up out of that resistance. But instead, here at Amravati, when I get the chance, I wash the dishes, because I find that that's quite a pleasant task, really, in the morning after the gruel, standing in the scullery, and sometimes very sunny morning, and the sun streaming in through the windows, and have this nice hot water and suds, and usually somebody else there to is helping to dry the dishes, and then you clean these nice utensils, these porcelain dishes or steel pots or whatever. And when you start looking at it in a reflective way, even sensually, it's a fairly pleasant thing to do, just as a sensual act of what you're actually touching and doing is, I find, essentially quite pleasing. It's not like a dirty, nasty, ugly feeling. And then the situation, I find the scullery here quite a pleasant place to be in anyway, physically, and so forth, that one is bringing into consciousness what's actually taking place and using an attitude towards it that isn't just, we're not just caught up into an attitude or a bias towards it that we have, that we might be carrying with us. Like if I were to just operate from my emotional reaction to the idea of washing the dishes that came up, say, from my childhood, then I could get out of it. I could say, I'm the abbot. Abbots shouldn't be washing dishes. Nobody ever asked me to wash the dishes anyways here. It's something you have to kind of volunteer and insist upon. So it's not like something that's been, that I'm kind of cornered into doing. Something I deliberately go out and seek. Because, and then because of that, my attitude towards it is not, I'm not coming from the little boy whose mummy is making him wash the dishes, but actually contemplating the situation as an experience, which is very different, because one isn't coming from the bias and the assumptions and the emotional reactions that one say tends to carry. One can carry on through one's life if you're not mindful, if you're not aware of yourself and how your mind works. I notice just like, say, getting up in the morning is another one. We have to get up usually 4 o'clock in the morning. But the meditation starts at 5 o'clock in the morning. So they ring the bell at 4, and then you've got an hour from 4 to 5. This hour can be an hour where you think, maybe I just need to get a few more minutes. Especially on a cold winter's morning, it's difficult to get out from under the duvet when it's cold out there. And then the mind can find all kinds of rational excuses, reasonable excuses to just a few more minutes, because I might fall asleep in the meditation if I don't get, you know, 15 more minutes. Or noticing the mental state that you're in when you wake up. Like I noticed with myself, there would tend to be, because of the because you have been, one has been sleeping for a while, I think the blood pressure is lower, and there's this a feeling of you know, you're not very bright and alert when you first wake up. So there's, it's easy to go negative with that state. If I'm not mindful and careful when I wake up, then the mind easily starts worrying, bringing up anything to worry about, go negative about. It will remember the previous day's problems or something that happened that was particularly unpleasant or unwanted, and the mind will kind of stay, that will linger around in the mind when you wake up. And you can find just that just being in that state is quite, you know, you dread the day. You think, have another day, having to do this and do that, and because the mind is going into that negative direction, then everything negative seems to spring from that. One can perceive the whole day as being another exercise in boredom or misery. So then, because with sati and sampajanya, one is reflecting on this, then you, how to change the direction instead of just being caught up in this habit and just, you know, doing things because the bell rings, you get up, and then you go to the morning meditation at 5 because you have to, because the Ajahn Sumedho will give me a dirty look if I don't arrive at 5, and going through life just because of bells ringing and social pressure. That's one way of doing it, isn't it? Or just living, like say, living your life just because to so people won't criticize you, and you feel you have to do these things, so you do them. Or transforming them into acts of, say, that one enjoys, one finds, say, enjoyment, or if one finds a sense of positive attitude towards them. So one way I used to do it was to, instead of getting up at 4, I'd get up at 3. And I thought that'd be more of a challenge than 4. And then getting up at 3, but doing things that, you know, like that energize, like doing physical exercises, doing things that kind of get everything going, your blood circulating, your whole system kind of moving and throbbing, rather than kind of lolling about in a state of kind of semi-depression and low energy. So I would do various, like, exercise, physical exercises, and take a shower, or do something, then to kind of sit and meditate for a while, or to maybe read something appropriate, to prepare myself for the morning chanting, so that the morning chanting isn't just another thing that you have to do. You're going to drag yourself over and plunk yourself down and go through the morning chanting, but actually make it a feature of the day, to where it's something that you kind of develop and cultivate morning chanting and meditation as something to treasure, rather than just something you have to do if you're a monk. So this is what I'm pointing to, is changing one's attitude, because this we can do. We can look at things in different ways. We can contemplate life from many angles, from different perspectives. The human mind is like that. We're not just stuck with what we have, as just the, you know, this is the way I am, and that's the only way I can be, kind of position. But we actually can contemplate our own existence, ask ourselves the questions, you know, who am I? What is the purpose of life? And we can actually change. We can deliberately choose to change our attitudes towards things, not to just make ourselves do it, but to change an attitude and then learn from that change. What is the result if I change my attitude towards washing the dishes? What is the result if I change my attitude about waking up in the morning? And about, like, the morning chanting can be seen as the thing you have to do. And then it becomes, because of that attitude, I have to do it. It's like mother telling you to wash the dishes. There's always this sense of resistance. Anything that you're kind of pressured into doing, one feels resistant to it. You know, you might do it, but it's always, there's a level of, oh, I've got to do it, it's my duty, or I've got to set an example for the rest, or there's always some kind of unpleasant feeling about it that makes it into another added misery to your life. Or, in itself, are any of these things miserable? Is morning chanting, getting up in the morning, washing the dishes, closing the door, are any of these things really awful, horrible experiences in themselves? You know, they just, you know, really like having to go down into the sewer and wade through excrement. Or are these just maybe, I mean, they can be pleasant or unpleasant according to our attitude towards them. Well, I see them in that way. Most of daily life is not particularly ha-ha pleasant in absolutely fascinating, wonderful, exciting things that one does in daily life, nor is it wading through a pit of excrement, absolutely horrible and dreadful. But it is neither particularly pleasant nor painful. And so our attitude towards it determines how we tend to experience it. And this past meditation retreat for the community over the past week, the monks and the nuns have been had a week of meditation in the retreat center and emphasizing positive thinking. Because this has been brought to my mind very strongly about that sometimes in a monastic situation, one can take it for granted. When anything like this becomes institutional, it becomes perfunctory. Anything that you do repeatedly over and over again, it becomes habitual. And one learns how to do it, and then you kind of go and you do it out of habit, a kind of perfunctoriness, a deadening perfunctoriness that can make our lives quite miserable, when actually the quality of a monastic life can be a very joyful experience. And that is making these ordinary, mundane things that we do into something that we note, we bring into our consciousness. We're looking at them now. We're feeling them. We're involved with what we're doing, even though it's a very simple thing like opening and closing a door, or putting on your socks, or washing the dishes. We're actually bringing attention and learning how to just be with the act itself, bringing attention to the body, to the physical feeling that you have at that moment, to use that as a foundation for mindfulness. And then to sustain awareness on it, to what you're doing, to be more aware where you realize where you tend to wander off and get caught up into just doing things and just doing things out of habit or wandering mind, doing one thing and thinking about something else. Then the training is to bring attention to keep reminding yourself, to use your ability to reflect and to note and to realize things so that your attention is always coming back to the present, to the body itself, to the action, to the situation that you're involved with. And you're doing it not in the critical way of saying doing the dishes is preventing me from doing my meditation, because then you only see doing the dishes as some obstacle, something you have to get done in order to get to the real practice, get over there onto the zafu, the meditation cushion, and sit there and become one of those sitters. Because washing the dishes is a disruption, distraction from sitting. You can't sit and wash the dishes here. Eventually, if you integrate practice in daily life like this, everything becomes the meditation mandala. The whole one's life is a continuous kind of meditation. And it's like living here, develop a mindfulness. Especially I know, like walking from my room, which is on the other side of this courtyard, over to this reception room, because I do that so many times a day, that has actually become quite a mindful thing for me to do. And things, you know, the problems of monastic life and people coming and going and the difficulties of things still affect your mind, but you can always compose yourself once you've established a Bodhi mandala or a place to be awake and alert, to be enlightened. So I could just live the life here and just running back and forth to my room from the reception room or the office, doing that just out of habit, or taking that particular action and making it into a special practice. And by doing that, by bringing it up as a significant experience, then I'm bringing a kind of ordinary thing that I do many times a day into a position of meditation. And so I don't feel deprived of the, I don't somehow living here at Amravati is and being abbot and having to go to the office, go to the reception room, and so forth, is in any way a disruption of my meditation. It's integrated into it. The life itself, the eating practice, the sleeping practice, the monastic routine, and even taking the disruptions or the surprise experiences as part of the practice. When one gets kind of addicted to tranquility, I remember experiencing in some of these retreats where you get very, very calm and very quiet, and the meditation hall is just completely still. Everybody, after a few days, and most everybody feeling this calm, this level of tranquility, and the meditation hall then is very still. And any kind of noise, it seems to reverberate around the meditation hall. Somebody rustles their robe, or these little packets of tissues fumbling into their bag and pulling out these crackly, irritating packets of Kleenex. Or somebody's taking a pill of some sort with these kind of modern ways that you kind of push a pill through an aluminium barrier and you hear this crack. And in meditation hall, this sounds really loud, and you can tell if you're very attached to this tranquility by the amount of annoyance you feel with these sounds. And years ago, when we had this old nun who died last year, Sister Upala, she used to go on these winter retreats with us. And of course, he was quite deaf, and he's getting on to 90. And of course, some of her movements were quite disruptive in the meditation sessions. And so, one could feel this sense of aversion arising. Thinking, I think it'd be better if Sister Upala stayed in her room to meditate. And then, Because then you suddenly you want it. You're getting so attached to this level of silence, and it made you even more kind of mean-hearted. It didn't, instead of making you nicer and more compassionate, you became more selfish. You wanted to get rid of her. So then you contemplate this. Is this, you know, this the right practice? Am I doing the right practice? And so then contemplating this, you know, changing the attitude to the fact, instead of going in wanting this tranquility and this total silence, regarding every disruption and everything as an opportunity for practice, as something to welcome, something to incorporate into your overall view of practice, rather than thinking that you can't practice if the conditions aren't just a certain way. Of course, this has some dangerous results too, because sometimes I start out these retreats telling everyone, you know, everything that happens is a part of the practice. So whatever happens, just regard it in that way. And a couple of years ago, on the winter's retreat here, all kinds of things happened. The freeze, the one person went a bit funny, and all kinds of all kinds of things happened. I thought maybe another time in Thailand, I was giving a retreat at the International Monastery in Thailand, and I said at the beginning, the first night in the evening, I said, whether there's a cyclone or a hurricane or whatever, it's a part of the practice. And that night, there is a hurricane. Nearly blew down my cootie. And everybody was blaming me for that hurricane. Walking meditation also is helpful. The meditation the Buddha used, the four postures, the sitting posture, standing, walking, and lying down. These are the ordinary postures that we have in daily life. We're either in one of those postures, no matter where we are. So notice that they're not extraordinary postures, like standing on your head or some very special posture. It's the very, they're the ordinary ones that we all use throughout daily life. And the mindfulness is established around the ordinary postures and the breathing of the body. And so that one's bringing attention to life as it really is, rather than thinking that you've got to develop special qualities or special abilities in order to realize the truth. You're, instead of using that assumption that you have to develop and get something or get rid of things, you're looking at it in a different way. You're noticing how it really is. What is standing or walking like, you know, as an experience? How to sustain and hold your attention on yourself while you're walking on a meditation path. You can see, and you go out in the field, various places, or by the Nisoko Water Garden, these meditation paths that we've made. They may be about 25, 30 of our steps, and then you walk, you establish the path as, you know, 25, 30 steps, and then you develop mindfulness walking from one end of it to the other and back again, walking back and forth for an hour. And this is a very boring thing to do if you're looking at it in that way. But if you're using it as something to reflect upon, something to contemplate, and to bring attention, to train your mind to whenever it wanders off, starts getting caught up in its thoughts, wandering mind, you at that moment when you remember that you recollect that you're thinking about something else, then you train yourself to go back to what you're doing, to just the walking, the right, left foot touching the ground, and the points of stopping and starting, turning, are just noted, mentally noted, so that you're using just the form and the restriction of that particular situation to reflect upon and contemplate. And it's through this kind of training that we actually begin to, free ourselves from just the momentum of our habits and attitudes and assumptions of life, and begin to awaken to a reality, to the reality of Dhamma, in which we transcend all the confused emotional problems and convoluted ways of thinking and endless habits that we've acquired over the years, when we've just operated in life just through getting caught up into the material or conditioned world. So this is on meditation in daily life. Just sitting is not enough. Then today we had the Indian community come here to offer Dana, and this is a memorial day for great Indian Buddhist Dr. Ambedkar, who became a Buddhist in 1956 October 14th, 1956. Dr. Ambedkar made a public conversion in the city of Nagpur, advised, and he was from the untouchable caste, and he was a very well-educated man, and tried to uplift and tried to establish a proper role in the Hindu religion for his own people. But the caste system being so kind of fixed and rigid in India, there was never allowed, that people were always held back into these roles of untouchability. So Dr. Ambedkar decided that Buddhism was the only really viable alternative to try to change the direction and lift these people out of this oppression. So in 1956, he made a public, he took the three refuges and the five precepts, and advised all these millions of people who are in these low castes to make this conversion. So over the years now, there's been millions of Indians who have become Buddhists, and this is a celebration of Diksha Day. And then one of the irritating things that we all find is with Buddhism in India is that the Hindus insist that Buddhism is another form of Hinduism, and so the Indian people that were here today were telling me that they find this incredibly irritating, and I found it that way too. When I was in India, they insist, they say, oh yes, Buddhist monk, but Buddha was an avatar of Vishnu, and they kind of make these assumptions. And so the Indian community asked me to make a special reference today on on this issue of the relationship of Buddhism to Hinduism. And I think that the Hindu tendency is to include Buddha within their system of avatars. But as far as Buddhists go, we don't really regard it in that way, because there's no reference in any of our scriptures at all to Buddha being an avatar of Vishnu or any other deity. In fact, the emphasis that the Buddha made was it's that whole tradition, that whole kind of lineage of Buddhists, We have a chant called the Adanadiya chant, where we recite, it's called the 28 Buddhas, and there's a whole lineage of Buddhas prior to Gautama the Buddha, or Shakyamuni Buddha of India, to our teacher from the what we know of Buddhism as it is today. But before that, there's this whole list of 27 other Buddhas dating way back to, who knows, maybe Atlantis or Lemuria. It boggles the imagination to try to think it out. But what it's really saying in practical terms is that this awakened state of humanity, of a human being, has always been possible. You know, in whatever evolutionary state humanity's been in, there's always been a Buddha appropriate to that level. And that this Buddha it represents the pure intelligence of the universe. It's not like a Messiah image or a savior or a liberator or anything like that. It's a teacher or one who establishes an appropriate means for liberation for a certain age. And the Shakyamuni Buddha, or Gautama the Buddha, established the Four Noble Truths as the essential teaching. This was 2,537 years ago in India. And this teaching is what we use. This is the main practice, like here, when especially in the Theravada form of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths is really the thrust and the essential teaching, and it is the establishment of the universal pattern of existence. Because in the Four Noble Truths, you have the truth of the arising and the cessation of the condition of any condition. So when we meditate, we're contemplating this pattern, this impermanent. The pattern of impermanence as it relates to everything that we're experiencing through the senses. And this teaching is a teaching that was established various theories, but one that seems generally taken for granted is for 5,000 years this teaching will exist. And so we've reached 2,537 years. And it was in 1956 that there was the Buddhist Jayanti, the 2,500th year of Buddhism in the world, and Buddhism as we know it. And that was the year Dr. Ambedkar made his profound statement and conversion. And when we look back, I was telling the Indian community early this morning how that year, 1956, seemed to be a year that many, the English Sangha Trust was established here in Britain. And I think that was about the time I became a Buddhist, 1956. And there seems to be a sudden kind of upsurge of interest in West and in India in Buddhism, and especially in Buddhist meditation. Countries like Thailand also, there was suddenly a shift from just ceremony, Buddhist ceremony and custom, into meditation practice. Even in the Buddhist countries themselves, there seemed to be something changing from just the kind of ruts of, because any religion can easily sink into just being ceremonies and just academic approaches to. But in 1956, I know in Thailand, there was suddenly an interest, growing interest among Thai Buddhists to actually practice meditation, return to the actual practice. But in our relationships with other religions, say with the Hindus or the Christians or the Muslims, the attitude is always, one of listening and non-controversy. No use kind of punching them in the nose or telling them off. If they want to think we're Hindus, go ahead. Let them. Because, but in our own minds, we're, you know, this is not really terribly important, because the practice, the way of looking at Dhamma is the important issue, not the particular customs and attitudes of our own tradition or any other religious tradition. Because I was brought up as a Christian, where they think every religion is wrong except ours. I mean, they wouldn't include you. They'd just throw you out. So now I think it's time for tea, and I want to invite everybody to have a cup of tea in 20 minutes. We can, for those of you who have the time and the inclination to come back, and we can have a dialogue.